Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's June the 7th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, first some housekeeping stuff. Guys, once more, I'm getting complaints about my quote-unquote lack of response to emails. I suspect this is one of those things that I have to go over every few months to make sure it sinks in and the new people hear it, so fine, let's recap this one. I used to have two part-time assistants, but I couldn't pay them a living wage, and so they had to get real jobs. Although I do have help on things like technical and other stuff where needed, basically all the donkey work has now fallen right back onto me. Now, this is one of the reasons I haven't been able to get Section 4 of Freedom Sons started. I simply don't have time anymore to clear my head, clear the decks, ravel up my concentration, sit down, and write. I'm spending most of my time doing work that should be done by other people, by a secretary or a PA, stuff I should have a staff to do. Well, if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. This includes at least 2 or 3 hours per day of what the Irish call doing messages, meaning running around town doing all kinds of errands. Now, that 2 or 3 hours per day mounts up. Plus, almost every day, there's at least one example of what I call DE, drop everything stuff, which is usually some kind of idiotic and artificial crisis having to do with the Internet, of course, wherein I must, nevertheless, drop everything I'm doing and deal with it because there's no one else who can. I don't have multiple clones of myself, the assistants and the staff who would be necessary to run a proper political operation. This is because I do not have the money to pay them, and Americans will do nothing unless they are paid. Doing something because it is right and committing their lives to a sacred ideal is simply not something that the American mind and personality is capable of any longer. Now, let me be clear here. I'm not bitching and moaning about this. I have eventually figured out that it does no good. I've already stated about 10,000 times that our poor character is probably going to kill us all. Everyone claims they get it, they agree, they say, yeah, yeah, Harold, you tell them, and then they do nothing. I'm not making excuses, I'm simply explaining to you why I'm not able to sit down and write you all long, long personal emails every day, never mind actual letters. Right now, I'm receiving well over 200 emails per day, that is, per 24-hour period, probably more in the neighborhood of 225 or 250. Now, that does not include spams wanting to sell me drugs from Canadian pharmacies, or refinance my mortgage, or enhance my male member, or urgent communications from bankers and generals in Nigeria who want to send me $1 million if I'll be so kind as to send them my bank account number, that kind of thing. I mean real emails that require some kind of response from me, even if it's only a brief tap and click or two. Now, all of this mounts up, and it takes up an immense amount of my time that I really do need for other things, like writing. But I have to take care of these emails without seeming excessively rude, because a lot of these emails come from the very same people whose $10 and $20 donations and voluntary dues keep me sleeping in a bed at night and not under a bridge. I am painfully conscious of this, so let me iterate something right here and now. I will never deliberately be rude or brusque or dismissive to someone. That would be really foolish of me, biting the hand that feeds me. But you have to bear in mind that I am here on my own now. Realistically, that's not going to change anytime soon, and the time I have available to sit down and compose long, detailed, chatty, personal messages and letters to people is distinctly limited. I still get contacts from people who want to form a committee of correspondence like they had in 1775, but people misunderstand that term. Each colony appointed a few educated and literate men to communicate with the other colonies because in those days there was no telephone or TV or telegraph or internet, and communications moved at the speed of a horse or sometimes a wooden sailing ship. The correspondence in question, from people like John Adams and John Hancock and Benjamin Franklin, occasionally wandered off into high-flying ideological and political writing, true, but mostly it was about accumulating muskets and gunpowder and horses and stashing them in somebody's barn, then going out and burning a revenue cutter or a British tax office, preferably with a tax collector inside. A large part of my incoming email consists of people sending me links to websites and YouTube videos with comments like, Hurl, you gotta see this, you gotta see this. Almost never is there any explanation as to exactly what it is that I gotta see, so I can't really triage it, especially YouTube's. However, if I don't at least take a look at it, not only would that really be rude, but it would also be very embarrassing when the same person demands that I respond with an opinion on whatever it is I'm supposed to have seen. I usually, when this happens, I'll click on the link, and I'll at least glance over the site or the YouTube or whatever. This is where I could really, really use an assistant, and where the two I had really used to help me a lot, just looking at things on the net and letting me know if there was anything there I really did need to see. Now, don't get me wrong, many of these websites and YouTubes really are interesting, and a lot of times I get sucked into watching whatever it is, and then I turn around and it's 10, 12, 15 minutes gone before I move on to the next one. I'm sure you all get the picture. You just have to realize that even when I have enjoyed watching the site or the video or whatever, and I really do appreciate your drawing it to my attention, you're probably going to get the email equivalent of a monosyllabic grunt by way of thanks. I just don't have the time to sit down and write lengthy critiques of videos that, frankly, usually don't tell me or any of us anything we don't already know. Also, bear in mind that a lot of stuff just plain falls through the cracks. I get an email, I mean to answer it, but there's something I need to do or need to find out before I can respond, or I have a drop-everything moment and I have to go rushing off to deal with something else, and meanwhile the emails pile up, and yours is suddenly number 46 in the queue. That happens a lot. I say again, I never deliberately intend to be rude or brusque, but it's going to happen more and more, and frankly, you guys need to learn to take it in stride and not act like I have wounded you to the quick because I won't respond with a 500-word essay to every email I get. Now, before all of you come rushing forward wanting to be my assistant, don't bother. There are very special requirements by way of traceable past, track record, intelligence, literacy, and above all, full 24/7 dedication to the Northwest Republic, which most of you can't meet. Not the least of these is physical residence in the homeland. Anyway, I've gone into that before, and there's no point in my crying for the moon. If the white race simply doesn't produce men and women like that anymore, then I might as well be crying for a Triceratops, another extinct species. One final thing. Please do not send me inquiries about events or procedures or anything to do with the NF Forum or the NWNet social network sites. I am not the webmaster there, and I have no idea what's going on with any of that. I show up on NF Forum once every few weeks, and that's about it. Once again, it's a matter of time. I simply cannot undertake the running of a website or a bulletin board. There should be a contact point on each site where you can email the webmaster.
Good evening, comrades. Alright, well tonight I'm going to be finally reviewing The Long-Awaited Mister by Alex Krtajic. This is a story about a businessman from England whose life, kind of like the life of Ebenezer Scrooge in some respect, has really revolved around business, has revolved around ways that he can be respectable and make money. The society around him is collapsing. In this book, he's middle-aged, and he's living in the year 2022. He has decided that it's really best for him to sort of insulate himself from the world around him, and he lives in England in a house that is rather set back in a wooded area, and he has a wife, but he has no children. He and his wife made the choice not to have any children because the world around them is collapsing financially and socially. And Mister has decided he's just going to devote himself to his reputation and also to his money. So he goes off to Spain. He has to deal with a very crowded airport, and he's going to be on a business trip. And at the airport, he winds up, well, he's a bit delayed. He has trouble getting on the flight. He ends up sitting next to a revisionist historian. He avoids talking too much to this historian because he doesn't want his reputation to be in any way tarnished. But as it turns out, both at the airport, in the plane, and in Spain itself, he gets into all of these allocations. He gets into a bit of a dispute with a cab driver, and then that ends up being rooted on security cameras. But he kind of ignores this. He thinks that maybe they don't really quite know who he is, and so he tries to continue on with this business trip. On his trip, he meets more people that are associated with the movement. He meets somebody who has an association with the esoteric Hitlerites. He ends up also coming in contact possibly with Kevin MacDonald. So this book contains a lot of sort of movement references. But throughout the book, the really important message of this book, although there's so many other things in it, but the really important message is that Mister is, as I've said, mainly concerned with his reputation and his money. And because he has insulated himself from the movement, he really doesn't have any help from potential friends in the movement, even though he still gets himself into trouble. At one point, he ends up being arrested and interrogated. He's had nothing to do with the movement. His meetings have been chance encounters. He has tried his best to kind of brush these people, but that doesn't entirely help him in the story. And in fact, at one point he has a chance to develop a friendship with David Duke, but he doesn't do this. And then a couple of weeks later, he hears that the United States has collapsed and David Duke is now the president of some southern states, which are kind of forming a new confederacy. And he admonishes himself because he didn't speak to Duke when he had the chance. So I guess the message is that even though you think that you're protecting yourself by not saying anything, and even if you think you have a lot of money, you may not really have a lot of money. And in the story, there's hyperinflation because he takes a cab ride and it costs $70,000. He ends up not losing everything from it because he's planned, but at the end of the book, it kind of leaves the reader sort of dangling because it says, well, this man is, he's sort of safe for now, but you don't really know for how long, because he does end up going back to England at the end of the book. You'll meet a lot of interesting characters. There's a character that's kind of a hoarder and a recluse. There's a woman that Mister meets in a cafe who has, over time, greatly altered her appearance. It's really hard to say what she's doing or why she's talking with Mister. My theory is that she's actually working for some group like the Esoteric Hitlerites, but she's really a spy. That's what I think, although we're never told this in the book, and it's also possible that she's just somebody who has wanted to assimilate herself into the society around her. But she does end up talking with Mister, and I think that's rather odd, so I think there's more to it, but we're never told. There are a lot of geopolitical references in the book, but the book is very much written from a European perspective. There's also a sort of a commentary on the book itself, because there are these two editors that at one point basically tell the main character that he's a character in a novel. So I thought that was terribly clever. I happen to say that I prefer reading these type of novels to the type of book that Pat Buchanan wrote, because instead of just a list of complaints, you actually have social problems actually highlighted, actually put into a real life situation, and that's why I love reading novels such as this. Now, this is a novel that actually does believe in global warming, so kind of like the anachrofuturism in that respect. And it's also a book that is anti-smoking, so a bit different from some of Harold's opinions in that respect. I really think that this is a work that has so many layers that there are so many things that I could talk about with this book. I feel it really deserves that kind of attention. It also brings up the work of Kevin MacDonald. I was considering discussing the work of Kevin MacDonald, and perhaps I'll do that at some future time. But I wasn't actually sure whether it has complete application for us or not, because I read the introduction of Kevin MacDonald's book. Really, I got the sense that he was praising the Northern Europeans for being universalist and sort of criticizing other groups for being less universalist. And if this is true, then I'm not really sure where to go with it in terms of our show, because if a white nationalist ideology is less universalist than, say, or is not a universalist ideology, then I'm not really sure whether MacDonald is for that or against it. I mean, is he more of an assimilationist, perhaps, at the end of the day? I suppose that's possible. However, in this book, because no distinction is made, Kevin gets into trouble, and he has to be rescued by people that are in the movement. So one of the things that Mr. laments is he says, well, when he was in trouble, you know, when Kevin was in trouble, he has friends. But when Mr. has problems, he doesn't really have friends, but he certainly has enemies. So it's really a book that relates to the song, for example, by Saga and maybe by Ian Stewart before that, sort of Mr. 9 to 5. I really would have to say that this book is a masterpiece. I don't know how many masterpieces we have in this movement, but I would highly recommend everyone should read it if they can get it. It's a fairly pricey book. You know, you may have to send away for it, but it's definitely worth the money. So thank you for listening. I rarely get a chance to talk about something that's so exciting as this book. And before I close, I'm tempted to say one more thing. This book also goes into esoteric Hitlerism a lot, and that is a philosophy that was developed by Miguel Sereno. I don't know whether I'm pronouncing that right or not, but at any rate, that was an author who was one of the first to recognize Hitler as an avatar. And I was speaking of this idea with a certain, well, I'll call him a religious leader. And he was saying that he believes that Hitler was a type of avatar, although not one of the liturgically accepted avatarial intercessions, but still an intercession of a sort. And this is what Savitri Devi writes about. It's talked about in this book. It also goes into some of the wilder theories. It goes into Antarctica and UFOs, which I find to be probably fantasy-based, quite frankly. But I think that is also a theory that is worth looking at, especially for me, the avatarial aspect of it. Of course, that can lead a person to read the Bhagavad Gita and so forth, and other commentaries that I often like to read. And in this book, and they're also kind of a neo-pagan group, you'll meet certain neo-pagans in this group. You'll meet a group called the Norwegian Heathen Front. You know, even though this book is fictional, there's certain elements of truth in it, so there's many different philosophical angles that you could follow from this book that I would say are very valuable. In some cases, it may take you to contradictory ends. I mean, the Norwegian Heathen group is also against celebration of Christmas, although I'm sure they have the celebration of Yule, and you'll find that controversy in this book. There's scarcely anything that you won't find in this book. The only thing that you wouldn't find, I suppose, is CI, because, again, it's written from a European perspective. So, again, I thank you for listening, and really this review is going to be a difficult one to top.
Okay, this week we will have our promised showcase of Rhodesian music, all from one artist, John Edmond, who is one of the only two old Rhodesian singers I could find who has anything available for download on the internet. The other was Clem Tholett, and I don't like his stuff for a variety of reasons. Didn't really like it when I was there either. When I asked for people to locate Rhodesian music for me, most of you sent me to one of the YouTubes of Rhodesians Never Die, which is a song I remember, but which I don't like and which I doubted even then. It is brash and swaggering and boastful about a country and a government that vowed to fight on for white civilization forever, and not only deported me and my American comrades in 1976 when we tried to give them what they had to have to survive, but in 1980, in fact, crumpled like a lawn chair and handed their country over to a creature who has turned out to be one of the more brutal and insane dictators even by African standards. It's not generally known, but under the terms of the Lancaster House Treaty, Ian Smith was given a clause allowing him to sell his cattle in South Africa and giving his own personal farm a permanent tax exemption, little things like that. Anyway, I don't have time to go over the whole history of the country, but we'll start off with the UDI song, UDI meaning Unilateral Declaration of Independence, which occurred on November the 11th, 1965, which is the beginning of summer in Rhodesia, and the rainy season, and probably the most beautiful time there. This is John Edmond.
Wagon wheels rode north, it has been many years. The country has been built and run by hardy pioneers. They fought the mad appealing and many a hardship too. But flag and furl will tell the world and sing this song to you. And you can call us rebels and you can call us rogues. We were founded by an Englishman by the name of Cecil Rhodes. We fought for this dear land of ours and many men did die. And we may have to fight again, for this is UDI. In a time of need we stood behind the motherland. Our soldiers fought in Flanders fields and in the desert sand. In steaming jungles we have fought the common enemy. But these things have been forgotten since the days of victory. And you can call us rebels and you can call us rogues. We were founded by an Englishman by the name of Cecil Rhodes. We fought for this dear land of ours and many men did die. And we may have to fight again, for this is UDI. And now the sun is setting upon a great regime. The children all are leaving the nest where they were weaned. Now the youngest child has left the parents and the home. And and it can prove its worth if it's only left alone. And you can call us rebels, and you can call us rogues. We were founded by an Englishman by the name of Cecil Rhodes. We fought for this dear land of ours, and many men did die. And we may have to fight again, for this is UDI. Call us rebels, and you can call us rogues. We were founded by an Englishman by the name of Cecil Rhodes. We fought for this dear land of ours, and many men to die. We may have to fight again, for this is UDI. You can call us rebels, and you can call us rogues.
Hi guys, this is Axis Sally, and I really didn't expect to be talking about transgenders again this week. I received an article about some dude who wants to compete in the Miss Universe pageant, and I guess they're going to let him do it because he cried like a girl over being told he couldn't do it. He says that he's competed in both women's and transgendered beauty contests before. So again, like most transgenders and other sexual weirdos, people are already going well out of their way to welcome his strange preferences. But it's not good enough for him. He can't just do the beauty contest with the other transgenders, he has to interfere with what was meant for normal women. But this piece doesn't necessarily have to be only about transgenders. So, if the rest of the women don't like it, really all they have to do is be better looking than some guy. Maybe this is more about how ugly and out of shape white women have gotten if they're all afraid that some man is going to look better in a dress than they do. If that's the case, why don't you do something about your own sad state of unattractiveness? Just like everything I've said about bullying and rejecting the idea that everyone is special, the thing is, some people are just not as good looking as other people and they don't deserve any special treatment if they want to enter a contest where you are rewarded for good looks. If you want to stand up on stage anyway because you think it's fun or whatever, go ahead, but don't blame everyone else when you don't win. It all comes down to your poor genetics or your lack of discipline. Some other girl who doesn't deserve a lot of attention because she isn't white is complaining that after winning one contest and qualifying to compete in another, her crown was revoked because she gained weight between contests. She's going on and on about how it was only a few pounds and how if they didn't want her to get fat, they should have told her what to eat, but then when they did tell her what to eat, she didn't like the food. Well, you won based on how you looked, and then you decided to ruin your look, so why do you expect that not to have any effect on your next contest? And as for not knowing what to eat, you knew what to eat when you won the first contest, so just do that again. One stupid fluff TV show I sometimes watch is Toddlers and Tiaras. In every one of these child pageants, there are a lot of cute little white kids, and then a few dumpy, unattractive black and Mexican kids. And I mean unattractive even by the standards of their race. These pageants don't offer a lot in the way of monetary prizes, but if they did, I imagine judges would be afraid to disqualify the non-whites for being homely because then their parents could play the race card. There is no excuse for a white woman to look like ass. Women of our race should, on average, be more attractive than women of other races. No white woman should fear that some guy is going to look better than she does just because he has long hair. Of course, we're all going to have different opinions on just what is attractive, but we can all work with what we have. Those who make no effort with their appearance usually know it and are the ones getting pissed off right now. If you don't love what you see in the mirror every day, you're doing something wrong and it's your own fault, so fix it. Or one day, some guy is going to walk by you in high heels and everyone will think he looks better than you. I'd like to talk about the Jewish influence of feminism and white women who want to properly balance family life with everything else. Many white women ask if, as white nationalists, they will be expected to give up a career in order to raise a family, or if they will have to have six or more children. The first question I have is, why is this seen as a bad thing? Why do we never hear women ask, will I be expected to leave my home and get a job? Or what if everyone says I should only have one or two children? Since all living organisms are made to create more and more copies of themselves, and since this drive is the drive that outlasts many others and forms the basis for mate selection, why do we not embrace opportunities that would allow us to fulfill this destiny? Why is balance, whatever that is, more important than seeing our race live on? I cannot tell someone else exactly how to raise her family. I know many couples who have very irregular work and school schedules that allow one parent to always be home. This is an acceptable arrangement for many. I know other women who form homeschooling co-ops in their neighborhoods, so all the children get the benefit of being educated by several white women. Likewise, there are white nationalist women who have four children, and also those who have six, eight, or more. There is no magic number, besides at least one and then as many more as possible from there. If, out of every population, two adults produce two offspring, the population will not even replace itself. When dealing with humans, we unfortunately have to take into account the possibility of race mixing, homosexuality, and deliberate refusal to bear children, which in this society manifests more often than not in white people. Aside from that, there is also early death or various reproductive difficulties. As harsh as it sounds, this means that all white couples would need to produce more than two children just for replacement alone in order to offset these possibilities. And, of course, we're not just trying to replace our population. Our numbers are so drastically small that we need to grow them as large as possible. It has been said that white females of childbearing age make up less than 2% of the world's population. Of course, most of these females are not racially aware, so the offspring they produce may not be white. A racially aware white family with many children is probably the rarest kind of family there is. Why would anyone be asking how they could get out of being a part of one? Jewish feminists have an interest in seeing that fewer white babies are born and encourage young white females to put off childbearing in order to further a career. As a result, we have white high school students who insist they don't want to be stuck at home with a bunch of children when they could instead be out earning a decent living and saving money for retirement and mortgages. Jew-run organizations like Planned Parenthood fill high school girls' heads with stories of how they will never have a future if they start having children too early, and will of course arrange free and secret abortions for teenage girls. Never mind that it was once common to get married at 15 or 16 and that our bodies are designed to reproduce earlier rather than later. Young women who list motherhood as their top aspiration are mocked and degraded. I cannot name one person who had a lot of children and then later wished some of them had not been born. I know several women who had no children and finally regretted it when they were 45 years old, or had only a few and then wished they had more. I also believe that anyone with an incredible skill should not let that skill go to waste, and if a white woman has studied or prepared extensively for a trade, she should be encouraged to return to that trade if at all possible. White people have so much to offer that it would be a mistake to exclude the female half of the white population from being able to provide a trade or service that would benefit other whites. But when white women become so fearful at the possibility of taking a few years off from that trade, or at having to do it infrequently or part-time, we know the Jew has been at work there. Again, why do white women not have fear of delaying childbearing, or of placing a young infant with multiple unknown caregivers? When we find ourselves fearing the wrong things and embracing the things which further separate us from what we were meant to do, it's a sign that some Jewish and feminist influence is still with us. When we recognize it, we can deal with it.
Right, this is the last of that big hour-long panel discussion we had a few weeks ago with me and Sally, the two Andys, and that guy whose name escapes me that we found at the bus stop. I was actually able to get 3 shows worth of airtime off that one, but I promise that from now on we will have no more panel discussions, or if we do, they will be grim and purposeful and focused, and there will be no more of this unseemly levity. No, I mean it. From now on, I'm going to be stern and focused and serious, and you people are going to start listening to me and doing what I say so that we can actually bring this movement off the internet and back into the real world. starting with all of you packing the goddamn moving van and the U-Haul trailer and getting your butts up here where you're supposed to be. Yes, I mean you. No, damn it, I mean it. Okay, these things could happen in almost any one of 100 ways. The way I describe in my books is just one of many, but one possible way is that, who knows, maybe somebody listening out there has just decided, hey, screw this stuff. Harold is too chicken shit to go out and start shooting. Fine, we're just going to do it ourselves. Maybe it will happen. That is not my actual intention, but if it happens that way, we'll just see how it plays out.
In nature, there tends to be a lot of common themes, and one of the common themes I think that we're all hitting on here is critical mass. Earlier, you were talking about it before you actually said it, and you were perfectly describing with the oil and everything going to hell here in the U.S., you were describing basically the Weimar Republic. You know, nobody wanted to do anything. They couldn't get any motion. They couldn't get any traction. You know, the rubber on the road, they couldn't get any traction until stuff just got so bad that people were like, F this, and started doing action. I guess it's like nature has very strict parameters that things live in and operate. You know, there's a human temperature. We can't get above 105 degrees or your brain pretty much cooks like a scrambled egg, and you can't get core temperature down below 86 or something like that, or you freeze to death. And that's because inside each of your cells, there's a certain temperature at which things operate the best and at which enzymatic reactions happen, yada, yada, yada. We all know that. We all know about critical mass for detonations of explosives, stuff like that. Well, there has to be a certain amount of energy. One guy getting pissed off and going and shooting a little nigger baby isn't going to do anything. Harold and us will get arrested and we'll get murdered in jail, or a drone will come blow us up or whatever. That's all it's going to accomplish. It's going to hurt more racially aware white people than it's going to hurt Zog. But when you have 10,000 pissed off white people and they're knocking over cop cars and they're going in and doing some danger, then all of a sudden that's going to have an effect. That's going to have some fruition to their action because it's going to have the support of the masses. And that's why the Northwest Front is so important to get established. Because we need to have the support of the community. We need to have the support of whites, both very pro-white nationalist, white separatist whites, but then also those that just prefer to be around whites. You know, the people that I rip on for just being racist. You know, they hate black people and that's about it, but they don't really want to change anything else. We don't want to alienate ourselves from them, even though we might despise just the simple honky-tonk nigger.
Long live Zimmerman.
Long live Zimmerman. Okay.
Spring on Ohio State's Black Culture Center.
What's a Black Cultural Center? Is that where you buy drugs?
it's like George Lincoln Rockwell said on that Canadian radio broadcast. It's a cattle car with heroin and wine.
And again, you see how slow
Thunderbird wine.
How slow this damn thing is coming up.
Night train.
Okay, well, anyway, the news story, which I can't bring up on my computer, says that someone sprayed Long Live Zimmerman on Ohio State's Black Cultural Center. Remember that thing after that, was it that thing in Louisiana, what, the little town in Louisiana? Anyway, they were there hanging up nooses everywhere, and teams of FBI agents were going in to places where someone allegedly hung a noose in a locker room and investigating it for civil rights, and hanging monkeys, hanging little monkey dolls. That was about, what, 5-6 years ago? Mm-hmm. I see right now that we're going to have another little cottage industry of civil rights violation here.
Wasn't that when Obama got elected? Yeah. They had all the hanging monkeys?
Hanging monkeys, yeah. We're going to have Long Live Zimmerman now.
This is Marines with explosives cause California mall evacuation.
Well.
Right below the Pope.
Okay. Pope takes the cross. Well, United States of Addiction painkiller sales soar.
Oh, you know, there's a little paper I saw at a restaurant I was in right before I came here, and it was actually talking about that same story.
Shots fired at Waffle House over a Facebook post.
Okay.
Niggers. I still call it niggers.
Let's see if we can get up. Well, if we can get the thing to load. Yeah, here we go.
Is that like the nigger bit?
Shots fired at Augusta Waffle House stemmed from Facebook.
It's just that over the last couple of years, we've had nothing but YouTube videos of niggers and Waffle Houses or whatever else tearing the whole place up.
It's a shame. Waffle Houses are good eating.
Yeah, actually they are. Investigators have arrested a female they say opened fire in the air at a Waffle House. She fired outside the Waffle House, blah, 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 blah. Found two groups of females. In a, you know, the way that they describe this, females, you can almost tell it's niggers.
Yeah.
If it was white women, the reporter might not even have been aware that he was doing it, but if it was white women, they'd say two groups of women. Okay. One group outside the restaurant was one desperate. Another group of persons started a verbal altercation.
Niggers,
yeah. The fight carried outside where a female fired four shots in the air when the handgun. Get my nine on your ass, bitch!
I took the ferry coming over here, and there were a bunch of white people there. There were no verbal altercations. In fact, everybody was strangers to everyone else there, but everybody was very friendly. This never happens with white people. It doesn't.
Investigators think the argument stemmed from a post on Facebook. They believe it might be related to a relationship status. It's not clear what relations the two groups have.
I've read a lot about people killing each other or assaulting each other over Facebook posts, and the two most common are the relationship status where, you know, one partner says in a relationship and the other says single, and then the one who says in a relationship is like, excuse me, what the hell?
Yeah.
And then the other one is when somebody fails to like a certain status or link, and then one person says, why didn't you like my status? So if you're dating someone, you know, if you've gone out a few times, just say you're in a relationship because you don't want them to come shoot you.
No, I know. I've read some of those stories. It's okay. There were three shell casings in the ground, blah, 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 outside the Waffle House, blah, blah, blah. Okay. Yeah, niggers. Especially in Augusta, Georgia. Yeah, that's going to be niggers.
Marines with, I mean, I know it's not racial, but Marines with explosives. Not that that's uncommon, but like California mall evacuation.
Well, a lot of California malls probably need to be blown up. Marines detained with military explosives described as remorseful.
Well, they would be.
Okay. Two Marines taken into custody in Redondo Beach, which I believe is a white area, in connection with explosive devices found in the back of their pickup truck were described by a local police captain as remorseful. They were shocked at the attention they had received. It sounds like white Marines. But apparently, they just drove off base with some kind of bomb in the back of their pickup truck.
With the head of the Spokane?
Okay, I don't know, yeah.
Yeah. Flyers sticking out of a paper bag.
In a backpack, yeah. Los Angeles County Sheriff's Bomb Squad was called to the scene and employed a robot to investigate the devices. Okay, must buy hybrid cars because of tornadoes, the Democratic senator says. It's your money or your life. Why must we buy hybrid cars because of tornadoes? Durbin, okay. Senator Dick Durbin. I say again, I was about to read it, and all this crap starts popping up. There's other things. It's getting harder and harder to find text articles. It's all videos now, which I suppose is one reason why we need to start making our own YouTube videos. But Senator Dick Durbin reacts to the tornadoes in Dallas, Texas earlier this week. Durbin calls for more laws regulating carbon output while he sends a dire warning that we must convert to hybrid cars or lose our life.
What?
Okay. I'm sure somebody, their house has just been torn away by a tornado and they're destitute and they lost everything. They really want to hear this guy tell them to go buy a Prius. Yeah. Limbaugh has a point. These liberal Democrats are just completely divorced from anything we would recognize as reality. It's your money or your life. We're either going to dedicate ourselves to a cleaner, more livable planet and accept the initial investment necessary, or we're going to pay a heavier price in terms of loss of human life, damage, and costs associated with it. I'm sure this is what these people who've been devastated by this tornado want to hear. Jesse Jackson calls on blacks to wear hoodies to polling places.
So Hispanic Jews can shoot them all before they get there. I love it!
Yeah. Well, do you realize that unless the Democrats can really win this in court, there are several states that when those blacks show up in hoodies to vote might actually ask for ID? This is just incredible. This is the most discriminatory, racist thing in the world. Yes. The Democrats are going to court to challenge some states in the South, mostly, that have passed laws stating that if you show up to vote, you got to, you know, show some kind of ID so that they know you're you. They claim that this will disenfranchise, as they put it, between 3 and 4 million Democratic voters. Who in this society does not have ID of some kind?
You have to have it to function.
Yes. I mean, of course, even illegal aliens have ID. It's fake, but they've got it.
Actually, in California, it's state issued.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, how do the niggers get their welfare checks? How do they cash them with that ID?
Well, apparently, though, 3 to 4 million Democratic voters, and this is in another story that I read yesterday, but he's talking about the same thing. 3 to 4 million Democratic voters will be affected by these laws because they don't have ID. how did they register to vote if they didn't have identification?
Where do they get this 3 million number?
How do they make it up?
Well, that's because that's how many fake voters the Democrats have on the rolls in these states.
They have ID.
It's like Obamacare.
No, they don't exist.
49 million Americans don't have health insurance. 49 million Americans don't have health insurance. 3 to 4 million niggers don't have IDs. 3 to 4 million niggers don't have
IDs. They probably just lost their IDs. Yeah. You know?
No, I'll tell you exactly what it is.
They traded it to the Mexicans for something.
Right. No, I'll tell you what it is. It's not that they don't have IDs. It's that they don't exist. The Democrats are really great on voting dead people and voting not. What do you think Akron was?
Voter.
Yeah. Well, Democrats in places like Chicago and Atlanta and other Democratic-held municipalities, the way that they sweep the boards is that, well, not most, but a lot of their voters just simply don't exist.
Maybe the niggers, they went to get ID, but they couldn't spell their own names, so they were sent home.
But no, seriously, several states now have these laws, and the Democrats are challenging it in court. Okay, to some degree, Rhodesia in the 1970s was kind of like living in England in World War II, which was the atmosphere that the government wanted to create in the people. Not too surprising, since many of them were British World War II vets themselves, and that was kind of the prime time of their lives. In many respects, the 1940s and 50s lasted a lot longer in Rhodesia than they did anywhere else. Now, the locally produced popular music on the radio was not exactly immortal tunes for the ages, considering what they had to work with. It was kind of fluffy sometimes, including this John Edmund number about a troopie on border duty who gets a weekend pass down to Salisbury, which, along with the country's second major city, Bulawayo, where I live, was actually a pretty cool place, as long as you knew the art of living your life outdoors or in some place besides an electronic screen, which people in that time and place did.
Rolling down to Salisbury Town, or is it my imagination? I got a pass, we're moving at last for rest and recuperation. Two bright starlight eyes will be smiling at me. Dark brown hair down, dancing, flying free. Two warm love-torn arms will be holding me tight. Just can't wait to be with my woman tonight. Rolling down to Salisbury Town, or is it my imagination? I got a pass, we're moving at last for rest and recuperation. Long walk, small talk, friends and my family. No greens, blue jeans, barefoot in good company. No packs, relax, sleep like a baby till 10. Haven't been in clover since I don't know when. Rolling down to Salisbury Town, or is it my imagination? I got a pass, we're moving at last for rest and recuperation. Up on neon tarmac, pavements and folk. Cocktail light ale, champagne, ouzo and coke. Downbeat, soft, sweet music playing till dawn. Watch the sun come up on somebody's lawn. Rolling down to Salisbury Town, or is it my imagination? I got a pass, we're moving at last for rest and recuperation.
Okay, now begins the grim and serious part of the podcast. First, a quick comment. For those of you who bother to follow the ins and outs and twists and turns of that 90s show, you'll be aware that I have now been proven right again regarding a series of events back then which involved a certain individual. I was not defaming anyone. I was simply telling the truth and trying to warn others. As so often occurs in our tiny little movement, it turns out that this person who claimed to be one of us was not as advertised. And all four of these morons who scream and scream on the internet that I'm defaming people, including our friend with the stapler, are now sitting there with egg dripping down their faces. I won't go any further into this because those of you who don't know, and by now that's probably the vast majority of you, don't need to know. Sometimes people of my generation forget just how long ago the 1970s, 1980s, and 1990s are for most of you. It's ancient history. I am not one of this tiny clique of movement internet aliases who intend to keep on wallowing in the past like a dog returning to its vomit, all the while hiding their own identities, of course. Not that I don't know who they are. Nor are most people like that. The 1990s was a very unpleasant time in our movement, and a lot of bad things happened. But for better or for worse, this period in our history is not something that we as a community seem to be willing or capable of facing up to honestly, nor is now the time to attempt it, since we're facing an existential threat as we never have before. You know, I've often wondered just what I could have accomplished over the past 30 years or so if I had not been compelled to force my way uphill, wading hip-deep in toxic waste spewed out by people who claim to believe as I do, but that's fruitless speculation. I would ask you to please bear in mind that all this crap you see on the internet about me and the NF and some other people who have displeased them down through the years is almost entirely the work of maybe half a dozen people, all of whose identities and motives are pretty much known to me and to everybody. Now, that's the thing about the internet. With a little skill, you can make four people or even one person seem like a whole army. That's why the government has invested so much in Cass Sunstein's cognitive dissonance program and things like persona management software for Facebook and blog comment sections. Now, these people from that 90s show, all four of them, apparently have no life at all and literally spend their days stalking me all over the internet. One kind of wonders how they afford the leisure time to do this, to the point where they show up usually about 2 hours after my name is mentioned anywhere on the internet. They must have a hell of an internet search software, but why the hell do they bother? Yes, that's always been one of the great mysteries about some of these people. Are they just plain assholes who have mental and emotional problems, and they've chosen the movement to wrestle with their demons in public? Or is someone putting them up to it, paying them to disrupt and spread chaos, confusion, and demoralization? Problem is, that's probably all beyond proof. Every now and then, one of them like Brian Holland or JT Reddy will step forward and admit that they've been paid by the FBI. And once in a blue moon, somebody paid by the ADL or SPLC even surfaces. But what about the 4 or sometimes 5 participants in that 90s show who managed to look like a whole legion on the internet? I've always been convinced that one of them, at least, is wearing more than one hat, and he has been for 25 years. And in this case, I think there is some evidence that is suggestive, if not conclusive, that this man is not who or what he claims to be. I'm sorry to say that I also believe that one of them isn't white nationalist at all. He's a relative of mine who has been driven to the point of madness because he believes that I destroyed his career prospects in life simply by being who I am. And there may be some truth in that, although it wasn't intentional, and it's the damn kikes who blacklisted him that he should be blaming and not me. Okay, enough obscure rambling on that topic. I know most of you haven't got a clue what I'm talking about. I want to read a short email from Ron in Richmond, Virginia, which I think I should address. Dear HAC, you complained about only getting 5,000 hits per week on northwestfront.org, but you should realize that the danger will come when people do start listening, when your hit rate starts climbing, and the FBI realize that people really are starting to listen to you. Yes, Ron, I know that, but what can I tell you? It has to be done. Right now, as the countdown to the Jewish attack on Iran and $17 per gallon gasoline is ticking away, the task that we have to concentrate on is breaking through the media's imposed quarantine of silence, letting white people know that we are here. It shouldn't be like that, of course. We should be way, way, way beyond that stage now. We should have an organization, a fighting revolutionary party, moving about in the streets here in the Northwest, in groups, putting up signs, holding impromptu street rallies, and making preparations behind the scene for when the balloon goes up. But we don't have that. We're still playing on our computers like so many Simpsons comic book guys. We should have been building an infrastructure here in the Northwest homeland for the past 50 years, beginning with that Aryan Nations compound in Hayden Lake and following up with dozens more such places all across the Northwest. But we didn't do that. Instead, a bunch of shaven-headed, tattooed punks hung around Pastor Butler's bunkhouse drinking beer and playing with guns until a couple of them lost the pastor his home in a moment of drunken idiocy. We should have party cells all over the Northwest, unit and cell leaders in every small town and in every big city neighborhood, getting ready for the $17 per gallon gas and the empty supermarket shelves and the unpaid police who will walk off the job to forage for their families and leave the rich bastards who caused it all unprotected. But we don't have that, because you're still sitting there in your roach-infested furnished apartment in Florida, or your freezing furnished apartment in Milwaukee, or your double-wide mobile home in Devil's Outhouse, Texas, or your chintzy McMansion in a Chicago suburb, while you moan and wail, "Oh, Harold, Harold, I can't move to the Northwest. I can't sell my house. My mortgage is underwater." We don't have any of what we need because the money that might have brought you here to the homeland where you belong and that might have gone towards party dues and other projects to give us what we need has instead gone to pay for your cable television at $75 or $100 a month. Game Boys. 12 packs of beer. I've said before, when the white race finally perishes from the face of the earth, our cosmic tombstone will read, "Here lies Aryan Man. He preferred the beer." I've said all this before, and I'm not mad, guys. I'm just being realistic. Most of you have made your choice. You prefer the beer in your roach-infested one-bedroom or your mother's basement, or wherever you're holed up listening to this, and there's nothing I can do about it. Soon, you will no longer have the opportunity to move to the Northwest homeland. When the time comes, which may well be within a year or so, depending on whether or not Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem can be talked down from the ledge, you will have to flee to the homeland, like the Horakova family and Freedom's Sons, with nothing but the shirts on your backs. I included that chapter for a reason, you know. And yes, you will most certainly have to flee. Look around you, where you're living now. Now, my guess is you're pretty much surrounded by niggers and Mexicans within a matter of a few miles at least. What's going to happen to you and your family, if any, when there are no more police to keep the niggers and the Mexicans away from you and your actual place of residence? When you pick up the phone to call 911 and you get an answering machine or an Obama re-election campaign ad? I mean, we talk about Mad Max and, "Oh, I'm going to defend my family. I'm going to defend my home, blah, 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 blah." No, this is the real world, guys. What are you going to do now in the real world when all of a sudden it's no longer bullshit? It's no longer conspiracy theory. It's no longer a bunch of guys sitting around in the garage swilling beer. It's real. It's actually happening. Guys, America is over. All those things that you may or may not have wanted out of America, from the white picket fence and the comfortable two-career marriage that'll support a family in a nice little house with 2.5 kids who will all go to college and be even better than you, that's gone forever. It's not going to happen anymore. Not to anyone in your generation, and those times are never coming back. You're going to have to become pioneers, whether you want to or not. It can be done, because I've seen it done. I have lived in a land where it was done. As recently as 122 years ago, our people literally created a whole nation out of nothing in 1 year. We lost it 90 years later because of exactly the same kind of weakness and cowardice that you're displaying now. But that doesn't mean that we give up the fight. One day, we will create a new Rhodesia somewhere on the face of the earth. Only this time it will be based on a proper racial ideal and not racial paternalism and not Jewish capitalism and not Colonel Blimp. We did it once, we'll do it again, and here in the Northwest we'll get it right. This is John Edmund.
Near the town of Fort Victoria, beneath the shade and sun, you will find a little cemetery with crosses 21. Hills of granite stand around a sentinel so bold and true, over all the graves of those who braved the hazards with salute. Tell me now, you granite mountains, so immovable yet free, how many crosses in this valley, how many crosses should there be? Near the town of Fort Victoria, a highway and a fence wind their way through hill and mountain, down the pass of Providence. When you travel there, remember as you ramble down the grades, that the ones who first came up there with the horses and the spades. Tell me now, you granite mountains, so immovable yet free, how many crosses in this valley, how many crosses should there be? Near the town of Fort Victoria, you can still hear the bell, once the bell that rang the warning of the mad Abilly yell. Now it rings a message out of hope for those who care to see the meaning of the crosses standing in that lonely cemetery. Tell me now, you granite mountains, so immovable yet free, how many crosses in this valley, how many crosses should there be? How many crosses in this valley, how many crosses should there be?
The following is an excerpt from the novel The Brigade by H.A. Covington. It is fiction, for now. These are the Northwest Volunteer Army General Orders. General Order Number 1. The Army Council of the Northwest Volunteer Army is hereby constituted as the governing body of the Northwest American Republic. The Army Council declares a state of martial law, which shall continue until such time as the sovereignty and independence of the Republic is established, and authority can be transferred to the government thereof, and a state president pro tem and national convention can be securely established under the provisions of the draft constitutional document published in the second edition of the Party Handbook dated January 2007. General Order Number 2. All officers and other ranks of the Northwest Volunteer Army, and all persons acting under the orders of the NVA, or acting in any way in assistance to or in furtherance of the strategic and tactical objectives of the NVA, or the Provisional Government of the Northwest American Republic, are herewith fully and permanently immunized from any and all legal prosecution or procedure for any and all actions undertaken in good faith toward the establishment of the Northwest American Republic as a sovereign nation. General Order Number 3. No officer or other rank of the Northwest Volunteer Army shall voluntarily surrender himself or any other personnel, weapons, or equipment under his command to the forces of the occupation while he or she still has the means and capability to resist and to continue operations. General Order Number 4. No Jew or other non-white person, no homosexual, and no white person engaged in interracial sexual activity shall reside within the boundaries of the Northwest American Republic or within any area of NVA operations. NVA field commanders shall deal with violators of this general order at their discretion. General Order Number 5. No officer or other rank of the Northwest Volunteer Army shall expropriate, confiscate, or seize any money, goods, materials, supplies, weapons, ammunition, vehicles, or other items of value, except that such goods or materials shall either be immediately paid for in cash or through presentation of an official receipt, such receipts where possible estimating the value of the goods taken, which receipts shall be honored for payment at a later date by the authorities of the Northwest American Republic. General Order Number 6. No officer or other rank of the Northwest Volunteer Army shall expropriate, confiscate, or seize any money, goods, materials, etc. for his or her own personal use or profit. General Order Number 7. The Provisional Government of the Northwest American Republic demands the complete and unambiguous loyalty and cooperation of all white residents of the NAR and of all areas of operation of the NVA, and will accept nothing less. Any and all collaboration, cooperation, informing, public incitement against the Republic or its armed forces, or giving of aid and comfort to the occupation authorities is prohibited, and will be dealt with by NVA field commanders at their discretion. General Order Number 8. All NVA field commanders and personnel will exercise every reasonable precaution to preserve the lives, liberty, and freedom of action of all NVA officers and volunteers, including their own. They will use every possible procedure and stratagem to maintain their commands intact, keep them in the field, and keep them fighting, consistent with the achievement of the Army's military objectives. General Order Number 9. No officer or other rank of the Northwest Volunteer Army shall conduct any negotiations, correspondence, or other contact with the occupation authorities, civil or military, with a view towards ending hostilities, laying down arms, or surrendering any NVA command without the approval and participation of the Army Council. General Order Number 10. For the duration of hostilities, and until this general order is rescinded by authority of the Army Council, no officer or other rank of the Northwest Volunteer Army shall consume any alcoholic beverage or consciousness-altering drug, with the exception of medical pharmaceuticals administered on the order of a doctor or medical officer or in a medical emergency situation. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Her daddy went to fight for the green and white. She won't forget that day. They were all at the old drill hall as the convoy pulled away. Her daddy went to fight for the green and white. It was hard to say goodbye. Tall and lean in his jungle green, she heard her mother cry. Green and white, you're flying in the blue Rhodesian sky. Green and white, you know that we all love you till we die. Her daddy went to fight for the green and white, and his first letter went, thanks for the chocks and the glory box and the kisses that you sent. Her daddy went to fight for the green and white. He said, I miss you all each day. Tall and lean in his jungle green, heard her mother say, green and white, you're flying in the blue Rhodesian sky. Green and white, you know that we all love you till we die. Her daddy went to fight for the green and white, but now they're not alone. They were all at the old drill hall as the company came home. Her daddy went to fight for the green and white, cause their country means everything. Tall